A couple of housekeeping items. Several of you have asked about the next lesson. No, I don't have them out yet. Hopefully Wednesday I will have those out, the next few that we'll go through. I imagine that we'll talk about the appearances of Christ today and then also on Wednesday and do a little bit of review over the kernel of the gospel. I would encourage you, too, to pick up a copy of the bulletin. Craig was kind enough to print it in color today. There's an article in there that discusses the issue of water and blood flowing from Jesus' side, and I think you'll find it beneficial in your own studies if you have that and keep it for your records. Steve also attached a PDF of that on the class website. There's also an article on there that was published about 30 years ago in the Journal of American, or the JAMA. Where's Sally? What does that stand for? Journal of American Medical Association. It was about the medical evidence for the suffering and death of Christ. You may find that interesting as well. There's a lot of graphs, artist renditions of what he would have gone through vis-a-vis scourging and crucifixion as well. If you'll look in Mark chapter 16, that's where we'll be beginning our study in just a few minutes. We've been talking about the kernel of the gospel. What does that phrase refer to? Death, burial, resurrection, and what else? Appearances. So we've got two primary facts. They are the fact that Christ died and that he arose. Of those four, which fact supports the fact that Jesus died? His burial. And which one supports the fact that he arose? His appearances. Okay. We have six texts that tell us about these four events. Obviously, the four Gospels. Then we have two more besides that. What are the other two texts that tell us about it? Can you just give me the name of the book? That'll be good.
Acts and 1 Corinthians.
We've already discussed Jesus' death. Could anyone tell me what the intention of scourging was? What was the MO behind that? Why would Romans do that to their victims before crucifying them? Weaken them through shock and blood loss, right? And this is significant because when Jesus died on the cross, did he die during the typical length of time that a person normally took?
No.
He's pretty quick, right? So there has to be a reason to explain why he dies so fast, and scourging is a big part of that. There was something done by the soldiers to confirm that Jesus died. I've already alluded to it already. What did they do? They pierced his side, and there's some evidence that comes from that. What's the evidence that confirms that he's dead?
Blood and water.
John records that, of course, in John 19. He says he writes this that you may believe. Obviously, he wants his audience to believe that there was good reason to confirm Jesus died. When they buried Jesus, how did they bury him in terms of his clothing? What did he look like?
Mummified.
Yeah, it's mummified. Wrapped up very, very tight. Was any additional weight on his body? Yeah, about 100 pounds of spices. What was the point of the spices? Why would they bury a body with those things?
Show honor.
Show honor?
Smell.
Yeah, smell. It was kind of an embalming process for them. And of course, we pointed out Lazarus didn't have that. After 4 days in the tomb, they tell Jesus there's going to be a stench. But after 3 days, with the Lord in the tomb and the women going back, there doesn't seem to be any concern for that. Tell me about the stone. Is this a small stone that's rolled over or a big one?
Large.
How do you know that?
The women were worried about how they're going to remove it.
Yeah, the women are concerned, how are we going to get in? There's nobody there to open the tomb for us. How are we going to anoint the body further? And yet, Joseph of Arimathea seems to roll the stone over by himself. Is he Superman? Somebody said yes? Is he Superman? How does he roll the stone by himself?
There's a block in the stone.
Yeah. Okay, so the stone is chalked with some smaller stones or something. All you got to do is kick that out of the way. Gravity does the rest of the work for you. It's rolled uphill, and then it comes downhill to cover the grave. When they buried his body, Jesus' enemies, of course, they weren't concerned at all that something might happen to the body, right? Yeah, they had guards. And then what did they do with the tomb itself?
Sealed it.
What was that like? How did that look? There was okay. There was a stamp placed inside some wax or some clay. And what was fixed by the wax or the clay? What was being draped over the tomb? Some rope, some cords, most likely. This would have been like the police ribbon at a crime scene. So that's how they sealed it. So if they've got the guard and if they've got the seal on the tomb, what are the chances of the tomb opening from the outside? Pretty slim, right? Were these guards, were they under any kind of incentive to make sure that nobody got into the tomb?
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve pointed out in our last class, the Philippian jailer. What was he prepared to do when it looked like his prisoners had flown the coop? Yeah, he thought it was better to take his own life than let the justice system take care of him. When Jesus comes back to life, how many people see the exact moment when his spirit returns to his body? None whatsoever. When the people find the tomb empty, the women when they show up, when John and Peter run to inspect it for themselves, the stone is rolled back. Is the stone rolled back so that Jesus could get out? It's so they could get in. If he's the Son of God, he doesn't need any help getting out, right? Doors closed when they meet, when he appears to them. We're going to talk about this appearance in a few minutes. And he just shows up in the middle of the room. Stones rolled back so they can see in. What about the clothes that he was wrapped up in? What happened to them? Were they just kind of strolled out on the floor? Folded neatly, left behind. If you're robbing a grave, would you expect to find that, you think, if you're the police investigator? Seems really weird, right? Especially if you're in a hurry to get in and out with your bounty. What about the guards? What did they tell people? What were they instructed to tell people about how that happened? Body was stolen, and how did that happen, according to the guards?
They were asleep.
They were asleep, which raises the question. How did they know what happened if they were asleep, right? In the first century, was it ever debated whether or not the tomb was found empty? Was that ever the issue? What was the issue?
How did it happen?
How did it happen? Naturally, which would be body snatching, or supernaturally, which would be a miracle and indicative that Jesus was more than just a carpenter. Okay, look at Mark chapter 16. We're going to talk about his appearances. If I've counted these right, we've got 12 in our six books. 12 distinct appearances mentioned. This is not a list of every appearance of Jesus in the New Testament. There is at least one other appearance of Christ. Can anybody think of that one?
Paul.
I've got Paul on here. Another guy I'm thinking of. He wrote a letter to seven churches in Asia.
John.
Jesus appeared to him. I don't have it listed here because the first 12 that we have, these are appearances that are designed to produce faith. And the appearance to John when he writes Revelation is designed to encourage and strengthen faith that already exists. The message that he has for them is be faithful even to the point of death and you will receive a crown of life. So we're not going to talk about that one so much as we are these. Of course, these appearances, they serve more than one purpose in some cases. When Jesus appears to Paul, it's not just to change the way that he thinks. It's also to equip him to be what? What did people like Paul and Peter and John, what did they have to have seen? We know it was Jesus, but they had to have seen him in order to serve in what capacity? An apostle, right? They had to have seen him resurrected in order to be confirmed as, or to be qualified to be an apostle. So that these appearances serve more than one purpose in some cases, but the main thing we're interested in is what we can learn about them proving that Jesus did come back from the dead. In Mark chapter 16 and verse 9, this is Resurrection Sunday. After he had risen early on the first day of the week, he first appeared to Mary Magdalene. Verse 10, she went and reported to those who had been with him. Who would that be? The disciples, soon to be the apostles. And in John's account in chapter 20, where we will look in just a minute, specifically he mentions himself and Peter. When she goes to them, they are mourning and weeping. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they refused to believe it. Well, You read about their disbelief in verses 10 and 11. You don't read about her disbelief in verse 9. Is Mary a gullible witness?
No,
she's not. Quite the contrary. Look over in John chapter 20. John 20, verses 1 and 2. On the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark and saw the stone already taken away from the tomb. So she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, now watch what she says. They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. Who's they? Possibly. Maybe Romans? She doesn't say, but we speak this way sometimes, right? We say they. We may not necessarily identify who we're talking about, but we may just indicate that we feel like someone is out to get us. There's a conspiracy of some sort. That's what she thinks happened. Somebody had a plot, a very nasty plot, to remove and dishonor the body of her Lord. They've taken it away, so now she's going to go and tell the others. Now, in verses 3 through 9, or 10, Peter and John, they run back. They examine the tomb for themselves. In verse 8, the other disciple who had first come to the tomb, this is John, then also entered and he saw and believed. Now, when he says he believed, it just means he believed that the tomb was empty. He believed your story. They're running back because they're shocked. They're shocked that somebody stole the body in their minds. In verse 9, you know that's the case because for as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. So the disciples went away again to their own homes. But Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping. So she's still there. Now why is she weeping?
Because
he's gone, doesn't know where he is. All she knows is somebody did something bad. They stole the body. So as she wept, she stooped and she looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet, where the body of Jesus had been lying. Now she would know that. She would know exactly where his body had been lying because Luke's account tells us that she, along with the other women from Galilee, they paid close attention not just to where the tomb was, but to how the body had been precisely laid within it. In verse 13, they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Here she is talking to angels, and perhaps she's not immediately aware of that, but if she is, she still persists in her disbelief that Jesus has come back just as he said he would. So is she a gullible woman? Is she quick to believe just any old thing somebody tells her about somebody coming back from the dead? No, she's not. And you know what? This is good for us. Mary is a disbeliever in the resurrection of Jesus. She makes a 180 in a few minutes. And this is helpful to our cause if we are interested in truth. What it tells us is that she's not gullible or easily misled. Nor is she hallucinating because she doesn't expect to see what she sees in verse 14. When she said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And he said to her, "Stop clinging to me." Here's a woman that doesn't expect to see her Lord. And when she sees him at first, she doesn't recognize him. Why is that, by the way?
Don't know.
We don't like saying that, do we? John doesn't tell us why. We don't know. Some possible suggestions. It may be, if you look back at verse 11... She wept And then Jesus says to her in verse 15, she's weeping. Does your vision ever get blurry when you're crying? Maybe she can't see him or recognize him at first because of the tears. Maybe like the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, she's prevented from recognizing him immediately. In verse 15, whatever she saw at first, if she didn't look at him directly, we know she made an assumption about who it was, the gardener. So maybe she wasn't carefully inspecting just because she thought, I already know who this guy is. Ronnie?
Well, she's definitely not expecting to see him alive.
Right.
So she probably just, like you say, she's crying so hard that she's not really paying attention. And since she doesn't expect it to be Jesus, since he's dead, as far as she knows.
Yeah. So she's certainly not expecting it. And, you know, sometimes when you see things that you never expect to see, it may take a while for your brain to realize what you've just witnessed. So there's any number of reasons from the text why it is that she may not have known it. We don't know exactly what the cause was, but we do know that John writing this account, evidently talking to Mary and getting her story from her, he seems to be interested only in telling the truth, even if that means including an embarrassing detail such as this. And it is slightly embarrassing. You'd think, here's a man preaching that Jesus came back from the dead, and he tells this story about Mary. Well, why didn't she recognize him immediately? Who knows?
Hey,
point is, she did recognize him eventually. Yes, sir?
Oh, I have a question. Would you consider that being common? You know, someone saying that they were raised from the dead. This is something that doesn't happen like day to day, you know, as if we get up the next day and go to work. So, you know, would you be safe to say that, you know, because this is not common for her to have that type of reaction?
Sure. Yeah, then go back to what Ronnie said. She's not expecting him to be back from the dead. So it'd be easy for her perhaps to misinterpret what she saw. I do know she was a careful observer of what she looked at. If you look back in verse 11, she stooped and looked into the tomb. She's also someone that had previously seen exactly where the body had been laid. So she's a woman that had all the details. She knew the facts. And then you look at the senses involved here. She heard him, called her by name. She saw him. Then in verse 17, what's she doing? Yeah. Tightly. Stop clinging to me. Maybe because she's afraid to let him go. Already lost him once. Then she thought she lost him again. Somebody stealing the body. Now here he is in front of me alive. Never expected to see that. You're not going anywhere. I'm not letting you out of my sight. So this is the first appearance that we have. Not a gullible person. And certainly not somebody that expected to see this, which would rule against a hallucination. All right. Let's look over in Matthew chapter 28. The Lord appears first to Mary Magdalene, but then he appears to the other women as a group. The Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Luke say that angels appear to these women. Matthew lists the appearance of the angels in the first part of the chapter. But then down in verse 8 and following, he also includes an appearance of Christ himself. In verse 8, they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to report it to his disciples. They were leaving with joy because the angels have already told them what has occurred. Now in verse 9, they'll see it for themselves. Jesus met them and greeted them. They came, took hold of his feet, and worshipped him. Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and take word to my brethren to leave for Galilee, and there they will see me." So here we are. Got some more women here. Look back over in Mark chapter 16. His initial appearances being to women are significant for another reason that I hope to discuss in a future class. And that has to do with the way that the testimony of women was viewed in terms of a court of law. Their testimony was not considered to be worth that much in their day and age. In Mark chapter 16, verse 1, actually verse 1, the Sabbath was over. Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Salome, they bought spices so that they might come and anoint him. Very early on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. They were saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb? Are they expecting to see him alive? No, they're not. They are skeptics in the sense of the resurrection of Jesus. They don't believe in that yet. So here are people that would agree with perhaps the vast majority of the world today. If you ask them, did Jesus come back from the dead in this very moment, they'd tell you no. But they, like Mary, make a 180. Look in Luke chapter 24. Luke chapter 24 and verse 1, you read about them coming to the tomb and why they're going there. Verse 2, they find the stone rolled away. Verse 3, when they entered, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. So here is testimony from the mouth of people that actually went into the tomb itself. Again, in the first century, the issue was never whether or not the tomb was found empty. This is one reason why. You had people that were doubters, that were unbelievers in the resurrection, that inspected the tomb for themselves. The question, again, was always, how did it come to be that way? They noted that the tomb was empty. If you look back in chapter 23, in verse 55, these are the best people to know where the tomb is. In verse 55, the women who had come with him out of Galilee followed. That is the burial procession. They're following after that. They saw the tomb and how his body was laid. Not only did they know where he was buried, they knew exactly how he was buried, where his body was positioned. So these are careful witnesses, again in command of all the facts and the details that matter to the case. Now we have not just one person in this instance, but several. Several people that don't expect to see Jesus of Nazareth back from the dead, and yet they all claim to see him. The exact same thing. Multiple witnesses testifying, and again, like Mary, they heard. They saw, and back in Matthew's gospel, you read that they touched. They grabbed a hold of what? His feet. That's right. Grabbed a hold of his feet. Now let's talk about Peter. We have Peter listed for us in two separate places. Paul mentions Peter by himself back in 1 Corinthians 15. This may be one of the oldest catalogs of the appearances of Christ. I say that because this section of 1 Corinthians 15 may have even been in existence prior to Paul writing it. Chapter 15 and verse 5, he appeared to Cephas. That's the Aramaic name of Peter. So he's listed by himself, and then you have an appearance to the 12 after that in verse 5. Back in Luke's Gospel in chapter 24, you have the appearance of Jesus to Peter listed. If you look in Luke chapter 24, you don't actually read of the exact moment when it happened. Luke doesn't record it in his record of appearances. None of the Gospels do. You just have it being referenced. You have in Luke 24 two disciples, one named Cleopas and another that are on the road to Emmaus, a small town outside of the city of Jerusalem that Luke says was about 7 miles from the city. And Christ spends maybe 2 hours with these guys walking and talking with them. They finally realize who it is they're talking to, and in verse 34, they go and they tell the rest of the disciples. So this would be the core group, the 11. The Lord has appeared not only to us, but he's also risen and has appeared to Simon. That would be, of course, Peter. Now, the question occurs in verse 34, how would they have known this? Three men walking along the road. Only one of those men is in a position to know who he has appeared to. That is, of course, Jesus. He would have been able to tell them if he decided that he had already appeared to Simon. So we have him listed by himself prior to the rest of the disciples. Now, look back over in John's Gospel again in chapter 20. Let's talk about Peter and his state of mind. Was he anticipating a resurrection?
No.
When the guards come to arrest Jesus in the garden, what does Peter do? Meekly accept it, confident that his Lord will overcome?
Now you cut off the ear.
Cut off a guy's ear. Yeah. And how a fisherman did that, my suggestion is he missed the rest of his head because he's swinging wildly and he doesn't know what he's doing. So here's a man that doesn't understand what's going on and he doesn't like the way things are working out. So he decides to take matters into his own hands. When Jesus is arrested, Peter, of course, courageously follows him into the court. No, he does not. What does he do? Denies him three times. And he's just as broken and crushed as everybody else. In a previous text in Mark's that we just read, when Mary goes and talks to them, they're weeping. They're crying. These are grown men. All their hopes that they'd placed in Jesus have been dashed in their mind. If you look in John chapter 20, in verse 3, Peter and the other disciple went forth. They were going to the tomb. The two were running together. The other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. And so Simon Peter also came, following him, and entered the tomb, and he saw the linen wrappings lying there, the face cloth which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. Here are two guys, at the very least, would testify in court, "Yes, I found the tomb empty." Notice a few strange things about that. The grave clothes rolled up, neatly folded, and left behind, but I at least found it empty. Verses 8 through 10, which we read earlier, at this moment they only simply believe that the body is gone. In Luke's Gospel, chapter 24, Luke also records Peter going to the tomb. Verse 10, you have Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, other women telling these things to the apostles, but these words appear to them as nonsense. They would not believe them. These guys are not anticipating or expecting their master to come back from the dead. So they too are skeptics. But in verse 12, Peter got up, ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings only. And he went away to his home, marveling at what had happened. He's wondering who stole the body and why they leave the tomb that way. Somewhere in all of this, once he leaves and heads home, he gets a surprise. And the man who was a coward on Passover becomes a conqueror on Pentecost. I know of no other way to explain that than to accept what he says. The Lord Jesus appeared to me in the flesh. Not bleeding anymore from the scourge wounds. The side in his the hole in his side healed. The wounds in his hands healed. Some scars there, yes. But he's not crushed. He's not broken. Not like John saw and told the rest of them about, undoubtedly. Peter sees, not anticipating this, not in a frame of mind to hallucinate. Speaking of that, if you're still in Luke 24, look in verse 13. Cleopas and another disciple on the road to Emmaus. If you look at verse 13, Luke tells us on that very day, again, Resurrection Sunday, they're going to this small village about 7 miles from the city, and they're talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus approached and began traveling with them, but their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. Why? Don't know. Anybody like saying that? That's one of those things that, if you've heard Alex, of course he's not here the day we talk about the subject he's been bringing up to me over and over, but if you've been talking to Alex, you know this is one of the things that he's mentioned that's come up with his atheist friend that he's been talking with about these very things. They raised the question in verse 16, well, why didn't they recognize him if he's back from the dead? No idea. No idea why, if there is some supernatural intervention here that prevents it, what that's all about. But as Craig said a few weeks ago, this discussion would have been entirely different or never happened had these men known immediately who he was, perhaps. There's some good things for us to mull over as we look at this appearance that Jesus makes to these two men. If you look in verse 18, verse 17, what are these words that you are exchanging with one another as you are walking? They stood still looking sad. Why are they sad? He's dead. All this resurrection business, they believe in that? Not yet. They're sad. One of them, named Cleopas, answered and said to him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem and unaware of the things which have happened here in these days?" Little does he know. Jesus said, "What things?" Verse 19. Does he ask that because he doesn't know? Is he looking for information or is he looking for introspection? Yeah. He wants these guys to stop and think about what's happened. What have you heard so far from the women? What did you hear from me before I went to the cross? They tell him the story. And if you look down in verse 25, after he hears all these things, "Oh, foolish men and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken." Again, these are skeptics. These people are not gullible. They're not credulous. Verse 26, "Was it not necessary for the Christ to suffer these things and to enter into his glory?" Then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them the things concerning himself and all the scriptures. You should have listened to what the women told you. You should have thought about what I said. Did Jesus ever tell his disciples, "I'm going to go to the city, they're going to kill me, and I'm going to come back"? At least three times he told them that. You should have thought about what the prophets said, verse 27. You should have added all that up and concluded he's really back from the dead. You'll notice also, again, verse 13, Luke says it's about 7 miles, maybe a two-hour walk. This is a prolonged experience. It involves a rational discussion. It involves a change of venue. They're on the road. Then in verse 28, they get to the village. Verse 29, not even knowing who he is yet, they say, "Stay with us. It's getting evening. The day is nearly over." Verse 30, he begins to share a meal with them. So these are two guys that are slow to believe, and they have this over a lengthy period of time. All of this argues against one of the preferred explanations of doubters today, that they hallucinated all of this. They're not expecting this, and they have evidence that this is indeed not a ghost, as we'll see in a few minutes further down when he appears to the 11 minus Thomas. look in Mark chapter 16. Mark and Luke both record the sequence of events the same way here. He appears to the women, and then in Mark 16 verses 12 and 13, he appeared in a different form to two of them while they were walking along on their way to the country. They went away and reported it to the others, but they did not believe them either. Then in verse 14, afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at the table. So go back to Luke 24. This is what you have, but Luke's account is a little more involved as to what they witness and what they observe. Back in Luke chapter 24 and verse 31, the eyes of the two disciples were open and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. So in verse 33, they get up that very hour. They go back to Jerusalem. They've already walked maybe 2 hours and 7 miles. They're going to walk it all over again. They go back and return to Jerusalem. They found gathered together the 11 and those who were with them, saying, "The Lord has really arisen and has appeared to Simon." And so they tell him about what happened in verse 35, how he was recognized by them in the breaking of the bread. While they were telling these things, he himself stood in their midst and said to them, "Peace be to you." But they were startled and frightened and thought that they were seeing a spirit. This is a ghost. Why do they think that?
Jesus is dead.
He's dead. They don't expect him to come back. Verse 38, "Why are you troubled? Why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Touch me and see. For a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." So, three senses so far. Touch, sight, hearing, just a minute. And then if you look in verse 41, they still could not believe it because of their joy and amazement. He said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" Weird question, almost. But Luke says, verse 42, they gave him a piece of a broiled fish. He took it and ate it before them. All of which suggests he's really there in the flesh. This is a group, perhaps a little larger than the women that he appeared to earlier. And now also a group larger than the two on the road to Emmaus. A group of doubters. A group that have their senses fully engaged and their minds changed. Innes? Sure. So yeah, that's true too. Back in verse 36, if he makes this immediate appearance unexpectedly right in their midst, it's natural, verse 37, for them to be startled and frightened, as well as hearing the voice of their master that they know they shouldn't be hearing. He's got to be in the tomb. So this is all on the first Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, first day back from the dead. The last one we want to look at this morning is the 11 with Thomas. Look back over in John 20. You might think, well, it's kind of strange that in Mark's account, he says it's the 11. But if you read John's account, for example, down in verse 19 of John 20, when it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, this is immediately following his appearance to Mary Magdalene in the text, so it's still on the very same day that Jesus came back from the dead. You read that he appears where the disciples were, and by disciples you know specifically John is referring to the apostles. And if you look down at verse 24, he mentions that Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. So then, why does one text call it the 11? This text strangely calls it the 12, but we know it's not 12. What happened to Judas? He's dead by this point. That's one of those things we want to look at a later class when we talk about the agreement of the text and whether or not they contradict one another. That's a good question to consider. It is something that you may wonder. It's funny that people that don't believe in Jesus, they seem to know a few things about the Bible. They know that supposedly it contradicts itself. So it's one of those things we want to give some thought to. For now, though, let's focus on Thomas and his state of mind. In verse 25, the other disciples were saying to him, "We have seen the Lord." John says, "I saw him." Peter says, "I saw him." But he said, "Unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." What do we call Thomas today? What do people call him? Doubting Thomas, that's right. This is in spite of the testimony of people that he just met. His best friends. His closest acquaintances. He knows nobody on this earth better than he knows these men. In verse 26, after 8 days, his disciples were again inside, Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst and said, "Peace be with you." This is another moment where he just shows up in a room with a shut door. Then he said to Thomas, "Reach here with your finger, see my hands, and reach here with your hand and put it into my side. Do not be unbelieving, but believing." It's significant in verse 28. You don't even read about him touching the Lord. He just sees him and hears him, and he says, "My Lord and my God." Look in 1 John chapter 1. The disciples really look like a bunch of doofuses in the gospel accounts, over and over. They run away when the Lord is arrested. And then when he shows up, they're thick-headed all over again. I'm not saying that I would have been any better or any different, but it's significant that you read about them in this state of mind. If these men are making all of this up, they are really shooting themselves in the foot over and over, because they keep embarrassing themselves with the story that they tell, the books that they write. But then when you get to the book of Acts, they're completely different. And all of this would argue that these men, even if you were reasoning with someone that disbelieved in Jesus, insisted that they were mistaken, at the very least you had to admit they were honest. They were simply interested in telling the truth as they understood it. In 1 John chapter 1 and verse 1, John said, "What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life. The life was manifested, we have seen, we testify, we proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and we heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with His Son, Jesus Christ." Here are men that were unbelievers. They said, "We saw Him, we heard Him, we touched Him when He came back from the grave. We believe." Now, in a later class, we're going to find out how sincere they were in their belief. These guys were given truth serum in the first century. They were executed. They were tortured. They would not break. All of this argues from the data that we have as presented to us in the Gospels that they were not easily led from one belief into another, nor were they hallucinating and delirious. None of them expected to see what they saw, and there is a marked and profound change in their lives ever after. All right, Lord willing, we will talk about the appearances to everybody listed from number 7 to number 12 on Wednesday night.